there is a lot of interest now in public practices and social practices. And those practices in this iteration, although they show up all over the world at different points in time, the current wave of social practice, I think, has its origins in the work of the 1970s. And some, but not all of that, was feminist. Some of it, as I saw it in America and the United Kingdom, was also a push to what they called democratize art. So there was a push to expand audiences. At that time, there were also, particularly in California, there were many people of color and working class people moving through the university systems for the first time. And those people, as they exited, began making art that reflected their sensibility. So I would say that from that moment, that crystalline moment when art was dematerialized, people questioned the nature of art making, people considered expanding outside the walls of the museum. People talked about feminist content, content of ethnicity and cultural and national identities. Art became less universal and more specific. Audience became less generic and elitist and more general. At the same time, museums were pushing to expand. The ideas of they needed to expand their audience space. So all of these happened around the same time, but it is feminism was not a small part of that. It was a large part of that general thrust. And as a result, I would say, yes, the art world has adopted the ways of working that I've written about since the 70s. But no, it has not, in that if you look at the economic reward structures of the art world, they are still predominantly masculine. In other words, the people, the prices for work are still largely male, even though there are more women in the art world now than there were before. Those women are still token, and given in particular the number of women in art schools and the number of women who have major exhibitions out of art school and succeed in their careers, there's a huge discrepancy. So I would say both yes, mainstream art has adopted these ideas, but no, it has not implicated them in the reward structure and the economic structure of the art world. I think I was looking at your question, and I think it's very interesting. And I was puzzling over it because I've been thinking so much about economics lately that the relationship between economics and patriarchy is not clear to me. Obviously, it is more often men that will seek to gain economic, ascendancy, the economic power. But there are also, so you could say in one sense that men are just more enabled to gain economic advantage. And certainly the corporations, if you thought of it that way, might be radically masculine in their, gendering, the internet multinational corporations. If you go into, but can women do that? Yes, they don't. They're not able to do it. If they were given equal access, would they do it? So that's one substantial question to me is how does economics and gender, how do they relate? You know that women are more often poor. That women less often control economic resources, although they do, but less often. But the question to me is there a direct one-to-one relationship? Would women, given the opportunity, claim economic ascendancy as men have done? So I don't know about that. And then I started thinking about whether there were instances of patriarchal power that are not connected to economic advantage. And of course there are. And in particular, you see this in the area of violence against women. Although I believe that, so that a group of men in a group of men and women, at least as been demonstrated historically, violence against women will take place. Is it because of stronger physical power? Is it because of a different construction of sexuality, male sexuality? Is it because women are property? Is it because women give birth to children and therefore economically advantage rural people? I don't really, I'm sure theorists have worked on that. I haven't. But at the moment, I would say that I don't see the art world's patriarchal structure. Well, I was going to say I don't see it manifest in forms of working, but that's really not true. You can see it, and you can see examples, particularly historically, of women challenging ways of working that might be considered masculine or feminine. The problem with doing that is you get into saying, because Alan Kaprow was interested in relationality and subtle engagement between people, he was therefore feminine. And because Nikki de Saint-Phel dealt with shooting, paint at canvases with a gun, she was therefore interested or expressing masculinity. I think we would have to probe much deeper to really give you a strong answer on that. Well, I think you have a different sense, living where you do, about censorship in your country. I would say in my country and in my context, censorship is not so much a governmental effort to close down ideas, although certainly there have been historic instances, like with the Robert Mapplethorpe, where that's occurred in the arts. I mean, there's many, many instances of that. But by and large, I think censorship, I think more about the slow repression, the quiet deprivation of recognition that takes place around ideas. And of course, those would be gendered ideas, political ideas, economic ideas. But the way in which in our country, the illusion of freedom is perpetuated not by, lack of censorship per se, but by a proliferation of so many ideas that it's and a kind of an enforced consciousness, often politically paid for by people who would like to manipulate consciousness. Usually that takes place either around economics or around politics in our country. If you look, for example, at the rise of the Tea Party, there's a way in which ideas from the right are being massively perpetuated and supported by political campaigns and by secret PAC groups and donations and so on. The whole structure of American politics has changed now. Economically, and therefore that economic power will enforce certain kinds of values. So censorship in my experiences, and particularly in the arts, is only occasionally about actual censorship. It's more often about, the quiet deprivation of recognition. It does, but ironically, in our country, I don't think homosexual artists are disadvantaged. Again, David Warnerovich, he was clearly censored. But if you look at Glenn Ligon, he is not censored. He, in fact, is quite visible. If you look at Gilbert and George, they're highly visible. Kathy Opie is highly visible. So I think that ethnic women and homosexual artists are not particularly, they can be mainstreamed in American art and even in international art. In different cultures, for example, Spain, it may operate quite differently. I don't know. However, it's not censorship, but if you just look, as the Guerrilla Girls have, women are not shown as often as men anywhere, except maybe with our dear what's his, Arrakis, who made it a point of only, showing 50% women, 50% men. But around the world, that is not the case. He's quite unusual in that. No, I have not had that problem. I would say that the ways that when I work with institutions and even outside of institutions, the topics I work with are accepted, the strategies are accepted, but within institutions, the resources are more limited. And over the years, I've been known as a, quote, under-recognized artist, which means that I have not had the opportunities to do the work. So in my case, it wouldn't be people trying to change the way I work. It would just be people not showing the work. Or when I'm in a position of showing with a gallery, people being a little more... I've had many times I haven't had the same resources as a male colleague would have. So they don't try to change. That's where it goes back to economics again. How much of this is respecting male ideas, and how much of this is respecting the marketplace, in which men fare much better than women? Does that make sense? Men do better economically in the art world than women, and you have more resources when you do better economically. That's just the bottom line. So the only way you can make a case, I think it's not in terms of strategies. I think it's in terms of the market. So if you say women's ideas aren't accepted, it's very difficult to prove that. But I think if you say how many women are offered major exhibitions versus men, and how much money do they get to do those exhibitions versus men, then I think the picture emerges very, very clearly. Just like, for example, in the issue of violence against women, you can have a woman like myself or women who live middle or upper middle class lives who might say, violence against women is not a problem because we haven't experienced it in any significant way. But the issue politically is not to look at the personal experience, but to look collectively at the statistics on violence against women. And once you do that, you see very clearly that there is an inequity. And the same in the art world. You don't have to make an individual case like how I have experienced and what I've experienced. I've been fairly lucky in being able to do a lot of what I want to do, even though sexism exists. And I know how to work my way around individual sexist men that I run into when I do projects. But the problem isn't really evidenced by my individual experience. The problem is manifest by simply looking at major exhibitions, collections, how much money is given to what kind of projects. And if there's a gender discrepancy, it emerges immediately, and it will. It will emerge. I think it's a construct, an intellectual construct you're making, and I think it's as valid as any other construct. In other words, this is a metaphor that you create, and it allows people to think in certain ways about the system. I don't think about patriarchy in the same way you do. I don't have that kind of father. I didn't have that kind of, my mother was more ascendant, and I have a very different relationship than most people do to their families. I had a lovely family and a really strong interpersonal relationship, and my father was quite artistic and quite feminine. So, that notion of patriarchy is invested in a family system is not one that I personally would construct or identify with. It's as valid as any. I mean, it's a valid construct, as is an economic construct. And at the moment, I would certainly look more closely at the economics of the art world. That's what I've been looking at much more, strongly in the last several years. Well, yes, but the difficulty of there are many things to say about that. But first, I'm not sure I accept this entire concept of female masculinities. It's a nice word to mix things up, but it runs very close to having to define what a masculinity is and what a femininity is. Is feminine receptive and masculine aggressive, or is feminine aggressive and masculine receptive? So when you're playing with this idea of female masculinities, I think it's interesting to get us thinking, but I'm not sure in the end. It really depends upon how you define female masculinities. Do you mean women acting in ways that are traditionally ascribed to men? Okay, well, that is culturally different, as you probably know. What is masculine in England is different than what is masculine in America. You can see that by watching television. I mean, there are some fundamental underlying factors. Then on top of this grid, I would say you have to lay a couple of other sort of ways of thinking. One is economic. You have to look at the differences of working class, poor, middle class, and upper middle class, or privileged women and men, and how those might be enacted differently. In England, actually, upper class men have what in America would be considered a fairly some aspects of feminine behavior. So that's another grid. Now, if we take that complicated picture and lay it on the art world, I would say that successful women in the art world do have, like all artists, but they do have to construct their identity quite deliberately, and particularly performance artists like myself, and they construct that identity over time in connection with the context that they are rewarded within. So what I mean by that is performance artists were always seen as slightly crazy and idiosyncratic, out of the box, given to extremes, and very, in a sense, narcissistic. And so some of those characteristics that developed early on in the performance game stuck to performance artists. And now another thing that was very much in play as performance emerged in the 70s was gender, because there were many more women in performance art than there were at least represented well in other fields. So if you had a painting exhibition, you'd have many less women in it. But if you had a performance exhibition, you might well have 50% women. That was the way the field operated early on. And a lot of women went toward performance because it was kind of the Wild West of opportunity. Now, how did women constructed their identities in complex ways, because they were the conveyors of their art, their body was the conveyor of their artwork. So if you look at primary examples like Eleanor Anton and Hannah Wilkie, Annette Messager, Ulrika Rosenbach, all of these women, and myself included, we constructed our identities with respect to how it both reflected our own work and our own ideas, which were often very gendered, particularly at that moment when gender, to paint something pink was a gender challenge. So we constructed our identities in that moment. And for me, unlike, well, maybe all of these women, even if you look at Marina Abramović, all of us had a very strong masculine kind of component to our construction of our identity. And for me, that operated more psychodynamically. And in other words, because I was thinking of gender so much, I could enter a gendered, how do I explain it? I could behave in ways that I understood to be adopting certain characteristics that were traditionally ascribed to men. Like I would, I dress in a certain way. I used to wear, for example, work boots, and wearing work boots and skinny Levi's and hammering and nailing and doing construction work in my performances was an example of a kind of a gendering of my persona in performance. Whereas if you look at somebody like Hannah Wilke and Ulrika Rosenbach, they're very interesting because they had a much more voluptuous presence, a much more female, and Barbara Smith, you know, very femicentric. And to some degrees, they adopted different positions of, being subject of the male gaze, both in enticing and in empowered, in masculine ways. So they were very much playing with these concepts. Well, one of the things in 3 weeks in January, when I started thinking about redoing it, you know, it was not clear to me if there was even a reason to redo it. So I had to first look at the public sphere and people who were working here on violence against women to see if there was a need for such a project at this moment in time, a political need, because that's important if you're, you know, going to gather engagement in essentially, and if you're going to, you know, work toward something that has that is important in the social realm. So it as I talked to people who worked on violence against women, it seemed that they were eager to participate in something that would explore their collective experience and bring them back together. And it was true that there was still a very strong need for more visibility because there were still a strong incidence of violence against women in the city. So one of the questions that we posed once we had decided to do it was whether or not organizing on a grassroots level was, which is the way I approached 3 weeks in May, whether that was viable, still viable, and how it related to organizing electronically. So we had parallel campaigns. One was a kind of on the ground, person-to-person organizing through organizations by sending out teams of women to approach hundreds of organizations and bring them together, within the rubric of the project. And the other was a social media campaign. And as we thought about developing the social media campaign, we decided that you know, we looked at what's been successful and what's not been successful in organizing online. And there's obviously some cases in the Arab Spring and Iran and other places where online organizing has been extremely productive. But in terms of violence against women, there are networks like RAINN, RAINN, which there are many networks in Spain which collect stories, provide resources. We worked on that as well ourselves. But to what extent do those impact awareness, action, and cessation of violence? I really don't know. So in 3 weeks in January, we decided that what was still extremely true, even among the women that we worked with, if you'd been raped, you were deeply ashamed of it. And so even though there's more visibility, even though the city was much more mobilized, the police department much more willing, there were many, many organizations that believed in violence against women, nevertheless, women were still ashamed. And as long as that shame exists, you know, there's a way in which the crime is put at the feet of the victim. And we also felt that there was probably not as much reporting because of the rise in rape of college women. So college women were not coming forward because they were raped, you know, by dates, but in social situations and situations where they didn't want to deal with it. They didn't want to admit it was a rape, and it just went unreported. So we started a campaign. We decided that women, because of the shame, would still not come out and say, I was raped. We didn't want to put women in that situation. But what we did, our campaign was built around the idea, I know someone who was raped, do you? And so you could be that someone or you could simply know that someone, but we knew that pretty much every woman either was raped or knew somebody that was raped, you know, at least in you know, younger generations. Okay, so what we did was the hashtag was rape ends here, and the question was, I know someone, do you? And then we got some key figures like Jane Fonda and Eve Ensler to tweet that out to their social networks. And we partnered with Code Pink and Jody Evans. And we then started a Facebook page where we would introduce issues and topics. I think all of that exists someplace online that I can send you if you want. And the idea was to see if our organizing, we organized about 50 different events within the 3 weeks, you know, on live organizing. And then we had this online campaign. And, you know, we didn't create a conclusion that one was different or better than the other. But I think we opened up the issue of how does the internet work with divulging topics and issues that women are still very ashamed of. You know, so what's that personal engagement? Is it easier to disclose on the internet, or is it easier to disclose when you're looking at somebody in the face? Is it easier to organize women? I mean, can women be organized against rape? So we also had a lot of bloggers that we engaged in performances. Elena, this was probably in part influenced by your work when we did a performance where people were talking at the top of City Hall, and the only audience was bloggers, and they blogged what they saw as the people talk. So there was this live transmission of the mayor, the police chief, you know, that woman, Francesca Poletta, that I used as a resource for our project, you know, as a literary resource. And all of these eight people sat around this table. It was very beautiful. And they talked while there was a ring of people around them who blogged it. It was a very nice piece, I thought. And then right after that, we did an activist piece where right across the street, where all the women who had been who were activists in the town came, and they, you know, they participated in this performance that was a really direct person to person, as opposed to internet mediated experience. So that's the piece that we did. Digital citizenship, nice idea. I don't know how it plays out. You know, there are, I guess, people that are much more specialist, much more inclined, such as yourselves, probably, to comment on that. I would always ask this question, Elaine, and I asked you when we were working together, how many people actually see it? You know, the question of internet and engagement is, what is the scale of the audience? No, I just mean, one of the questions that one has to ask when one considers digital citizenship is, you know, who is actually looking, who has access? I think that question, I think that idea will become much more pertinent in the future when more people have access. But right now, it's sort of like, you know, we're in an in-between period where it's definitely, the internet has demonstrated its effectiveness and its problems, In the rise of internet pornography is obviously and its facilitation of international trafficking is obviously another kind of key issue one has to consider when one thinks about activating citizenship. But I think it's not, I don't think we have digital citizenship to any significant degree yet. And I don't even think we have digital audiences for art to any significant degree yet. But that, like you say, and I guess that's probably the last word on it, it is growing. I don't like stuff. I mean, I appreciate it intellectually. So there's a kind of an intellectual structure that I appreciate about the web, but there's not much. I mean, like for example, Elena's work, but there's not much that's physical or tactile or even haptic or emotional. I appreciate it intellectually, if that makes sense. I appreciate the idea of connectivity that's manifest, and this and the kind of simultaneity and the sort of. I appreciate the content of the work. I mean, I really like your work, Elena, and Toxic Lesbian's work. My appreciation is not the same as if I stood in front of a gorgeous, very large photograph. Those are very different kinds of appreciations for me. One is more intellectual and structural, and the other is more physical. So I don't, and then when you're sitting in a small group of women and you're talking and one woman is revealing something she has not revealed before, there's a kind of an emotional beauty to that that I also don't see, online or through internet or through this mediation that we have with this screen in front of us, or at least in front of me, although I really appreciate seeing you guys. It's a very nice camera. So the question is, do we need the physical and how much do we need the physical? I mean, I think we need the physical. I think we will always need it, whether it's part of art. But I very much have always appreciated the structural, the beauty of the structure, which is, where conceptual art comes in. You don't really find a Lawrence Wiener or an Alan Kaprow piece visually beautiful. You find them beautiful in a kind of with their intellectual coherency and the originality of the idea and the way pieces fit together. And I think the web is probably really good, particularly in the way you've explored it, Elena. It's really good for manifesting kinds of connectivities that are part of the aesthetic of social practice. Whether it really captures the direct engagement and that haptic quality of sitting in front of another person and having a kind of an emotional or physical or psychological connection, those are very different things so far. I really preface that with so far, because as we become more capable of doing three-dimensional projection and doing that kind of immersion technology where you actually, put on gloves and things and you can feel things. I mean, that might all change. I do believe that there'll be still a difference between, biological matter and electronic matter, but maybe that will sort of dissolve over time. I don't know. I do, but again, I have to ask who's listening. The web is predominantly, in my experience, which is not very deep, but in my experience, it's predominantly used to give voice. It's less used to receive voice. So, it still remains. I suspect what's going to happen is that political actors will more and more take over, and they will explore the ways to actually engage and activate a broader public. And that's really what happened in the Arab Spring, and it will be as true in presidential elections as it will in uprisings, as we progress generationally. I mean, it's even obvious that Obama uses the web more than his opponents. So as we progress and people have become more digitally sophisticated, the kind of manipulators of public consciousness who care about such things as elections will, in some way, I think, expand that use of the web as, you know, an activation site. Right now, it may give voice to those who don't have a public space. It is, you know, it looks like a democratic space. But the issue to me is not what you say, but it's the same in art. I can make all the art I want in my studio, but until I'm given the exhibition or the publication or the television interview, it remains in my studio. So if I sit in front of my computer and I send out my voice and no one's listening, it's irrelevant. So I think the issue, and it goes back to Yo-Yo, your first question about engagement, I think we have to more closely interrogate what we mean by engagement. And I don't have the answer, but I think this might be a really viable question. You know, one of the main concerns is engagement. How can we manage the engagement on the web, and what do we mean by engagement? In a sense, that might be, you know, what we want to think about. There's many more sophisticated people doing this all over the world.